From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actor and director Judith Malina. As co-founder of the Living Theater, Malina has challenged, provoked, and occasionally offended theatergoers with a revolutionary concept of theater. Also today, I interview our own Ed Ward, the man who gives us those weekly rock history lessons. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Mulgrew Miller and his quintet. And television critic David Bianculli reviews EastEnders, Britain's most popular serial drama, which is coming to American public television. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Much of America's experimental theater world owes a debt to the Living Theater, the company which was co-founded in the late 40s by the husband and wife team of Julian Beck and Judith Malina. Initially, their goal was to find a relevant, modern language for theater. After several years of performing avant-garde plays, they dispensed with fully scripted plays and created theater works that were a setting for controlled anarchy. The actors were not confined to the stage. They could prowl the audience, take off their clothes, and directly address individuals. And the audience was encouraged to verbally or even physically respond. Beck and Malina hoped their theater would create an atmosphere that encouraged nonviolent revolutionary action. Their goals and their means have always been controversial. Eric Bentley described their work as a kind of brainwashing. Clive Barnes saw it as the beginning of a new theatrical form which caters to man's emotional need for ritual and involvement. Julian Beck recently passed away. My guest Judith Malina has been trying to keep the Living Theater alive with the help of her new artistic co-director, Hanan Reznikoff. She's currently directing the off-Broadway show Us, and she's looking for a new home for the company. Earlier today, I spoke with Judith Malina from the NPR Bureau in New York. She told me what she and Julian Beck had in mind when they first formed the Living Theater.
What existed at the time was primarily the Broadway theater, and there was very little room there for a theater of ideas, a theater of action, a theater which could change the spectator from a passive observer into a participant and into a person whose life would be somehow affected by what had happened in those few hours. That is to make the theater a real means of communicating ideas that we felt passionately and that we felt need communication in this world.
This meant finding scripts that maybe hadn't been written yet, since most theater scripts are written for conventional theater companies.
It meant certainly also to inspire poets to write for the theater, to inspire thinkers to write for the theater, certainly that. And when those scripts didn't exist, we began to create collective creations or to adapt classical or old forms into new forms or to create new forms of theatrical activity altogether.
I want to ask you about a piece that the Living Theater became internationally famous for, and I'm thinking of Paradise Now, which was a piece that you toured with in 1968. This, I think, was a very good example of your attempts to break down the barrier between actor and audience.
Yes, we certainly tried in that to take the audience through a series of ceremonies and rituals and actions which would bring us and the audience members ever closer together.
What were your ways of engaging the audience in that play?
First of all, we spoke to them. We urged them to speak. We urged them to move. We embraced them. Sometimes we made love to them. And in the end, we took them out into the streets and faced the police.
When you say you made love to them, how literally do you mean that?
Literally.
Really?
Yes.
No, one of the things that happened in the play is that the actors would walk around the stage saying, "I'm not allowed to travel without a passport."
And then no, we didn't walk around the stage ever doing that.
No?
No. What we did was we approached the spectator and looked them close in the eye and said to one single spectator, one single actor, in a very close relationship, "I'm not allowed to travel without a passport." And then we turned away from them because it was the very beginning. This is just the opening moment of the play. And we turned away from them, and we created an alienated situation, a situation in which they would answer us or not answer us, but in which we no longer were in contact with them. And then we spent the rest of the evening getting closer to that particular spectator who became part of our obligation to, as we put it in the stage directions, to try to take that spectator to paradise, to try to make those spectators to whom we spoke and whom we touched and whom we embraced, to try to truly inspire that person to take the trip with us toward the beautiful nonviolent anarchist revolution.
One of the things that...
And that's what we were working for.
One of the things that you'd say to the people in the audience is, I'm not allowed to take my clothes off. And then a lot of the actors would take their clothes off.
We took our clothes off to the legal limit.
Mm-hmm.
that is, we wore what would be called a bikini, a small costume covering those parts of the body that's illegal to show. The spectators very often responded by taking all their clothes off. And once in the many performances on the tour, I was challenged by a spectator and took my clothes off one time. otherwise, we didn't do that. What it was about the prohibition, and therefore it wasn't really about our being able to break the prohibition, but it was about our hope that these foolish prohibitions, inhibitions of human nature could be overcome in a more trusting world. And I think that those spectators that then took their clothes off, I think, were making a daring and good gesture.
Were there ever people in the audience who couldn't handle the kind of confrontation that you were engaging them in? And I'm thinking, too, this was a period when probably a lot of people showed up in the theater high on acid or other drugs and I could just see the possibility for people to flip out in the audience.
Well, those who couldn't handle it and were in their right minds could certainly leave and go somewhere else. And many did. Those who didn't want to deal with that kind of confrontation could go away from it. If somebody is on an acid trip, I would... the thing to do for a person on an acid trip is to help them, and we were all there to help anyone that was unhappy, hysterical, crying, or miserable, or in even out of enthusiasm, endangering themselves or others. Sometimes that happened, because in 68, 69, a lot of people were doing that. And I very often dealt with those people. That was part of my area of obligation. And when that happened, I took them in the dressing room and did what I call the dressing room paradise with them and tried to take them to paradise, just as we were, that is, we continued our obligation to take each spectator to paradise. And then when we came out of the street and confronted the police, that was still our obligation. That is, to create a kind of glowing hopefulness, which is as close as I guess we can be to paradise in a world in which there continues to be much misery. But at least the sense that we're working to get rid of the misery can give us a kind of hopefulness.
My guest is Judith Malina, a co-founder of The Living Theater. She is directing a new play now in New York called Us. Now, I know you also wanted to blur the distinctions between art and the rest of life. And one of the things that happened in the early 60s when you were performing a piece called The Brig is that you were arrested, and you were arrested in the theater. The Brig was about conformity, and wasn't there almost a prison-like set?
It was a
on
prison.
The stage? It was a prison.
It was a stage set, but it was a prison. A brig means a military prison, actually a naval prison, and it was a play about the United States Marine Corps and its particular prison system. And it simulated very closely the actual conditions of a prison. And this was unbearably difficult for people to believe what goes on and how it is. And there was much feeling about it, much strong feeling about it, about human beings being treated that way. And the question of, was it true? were United States Marines in the internal prisons of the Marine Corps treated in that way or not. And it seems that it was very accurate. It was written by someone who was in such a Marine Corps prison. Two of the actors were Marines who knew the ropes of that story. And
but you were arrested for back taxes.
Yes.
And the police came and you, I think, barricaded yourself into the prison.
Yes,
I'd
imagine
set.
We didn't even owe any taxes. How could that have happened?
Well, what was it like for you to actually lock yourself in on the prison set where you were performing?
What was it like? It was like locking the door on a prison set where one was performing and saying that this was our work and this was our theater, and if anybody wanted to remove us from it, they'd have to take us away from it forcibly, which they did.
And then you ended up in a real prison.
In a real prison, and they closed the door in the real prison. But since we didn't owe any taxes, and it's since been proven that we didn't owe any taxes, and Julian Beck and I did do 60 days in jail for it. He did 60, I did 30, so maybe 90 altogether. But since we did serve time for something of which we were not culpable and have since proven ourselves not to have owed those taxes, clearly there must have been some other reason for them to have closed that theater since we didn't owe the taxes. And the reason was, certainly in my opinion, the reason is, that someone protested against the showing what really happens in the United States Marine Corps brig, and that the method of getting people for taxes, whether they owe them or not, that's an old ploy the United States uses against all kinds of people.
Well, you've been arrested in around 12 different countries on, mm-hmm. on lots of charges, nudity, I guess... provocation in some places too,
trespassing, mm-hmm. All kinds of things.
And you've been in prisons in I think around 12 different
that's right.
countries. While you have been a prisoner, have your theater techniques in any way helped you survive? Since you were used to a theater of provocation, you were used to really digging down into your own emotions, being very, very expressive. Did you try any of this out to get you by in prison? Did you interact with any of the prisoners in ways that you learned to interact in your confrontational
Surely.
Theater style?
Surely. We always did theater in prisons. When we were in jail, it was part of our obligation not to get through, but to help create the atmosphere for the beautiful nonviolent revolution in or out of jail. It doesn't matter. The same work has to be done. The same human contacts are made.
What would you do
with
in jail?
Prisoners, with guards. Let me give you an example. When we were, when the whole company was arrested in Brazil, the men were sent to a penitentiary where they were able to rehearse with the prisoners a prison play invented by the prisoners, a collective creation about the situation of being in the prison.
Were you ever disappointed in the power of theater? Did you ever feel like you wanted theater to change your life and to change the lives of the people who came to see it? Did you ever at some point go through a period of your life thinking, well, maybe theater doesn't have all the power that I want it to have?
If it had all the power that I wanted to have, there'd be no prisons, there'd be no weapons, there'd be no exploitation. I'm constantly disappointed that we don't create more revolutionary situation. And I'm constantly striving to... accelerate the process.
You and Julian Beck left America for many years and lived in different parts of Europe and toured a lot. Then you came back in when, the early 80s, was it?
Yeah, we came back 84.
It's interesting to me that although in your early career you never did much in terms of regular theater, in the 80s you both ended up taking on film roles. Julian Beck was in The Cotton Club and had a role in Miami Vice. You had a role in Miami Vice. You were featured in the movie Radio Days. And you were in Dog Day Afternoon also, weren't
yeah.
you? Did you do that for money or for the pleasure of acting in a movie?
Well, I like very much acting in the movies. I get a lot of pleasure out of doing it. I would prefer not to do it because it takes time and energy away from what I really want to do. And it's part of the tragedy of the artist and the American structure, American economic structure, artists have to do work they don't want to do in order to support themselves.
You know,
if I stay in Europe, yeah. I wouldn't have to do that kind of thing. But in the United States, unfortunately, there's no way to support art.
I remember Julian Beck's performance in the Cotton Club. I thought it was such a kind of robust performance. It was so much fun to watch.
Oh yes.
And the character was so totally unlike who he is, since he's a pacifist vegetarian playing this cold-hearted, tough-talking gangster.
Mm-hmm.
Did he take a certain pleasure in that? It would have really been a lot of fun to do that role.
Certainly, it was a lot of fun. And all the movie work I've done and all the TV work I've done has always been fun in the doing. As I say, what the problem with it is that I should be doing something else. I should be creating a spot for the Living Theater in New York. I'm working with a company that needs to work now, that desperately needs to work and that hasn't got a place of its own. And I should be doing that work instead of trying to earn a living. But I have to earn a living.
But when you take on a movie script, is it fun to practice?
It's always fun.
Yeah, and to practice like the craft of acting, learning the lines, getting into the character, the kinds of more traditional things that you seldom do.
It's more like athletics, I think, than like theater. You know, you try to achieve a certain goal. You try to achieve something. You try to hit something on the mark being exactly what the director wants. And I find it a lot like athletics. You know, like trying to do something correctly once, as opposed to developing over a year a role or a play and beginning to and able to deepen it.
My guest is Judith Malina, and we're talking about her work with the Living Theater, which she co-founded with Julian Beck in the late 1940s. We're going to talk more about her life and her work after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Judith Malina is my guest. Your husband, Julian Beck, died recently. He had been not only your husband, but your longtime collaborator in the Living Theater.
Yes.
Was it difficult to decide what to do with the Living Theater after he passed away? What direction to take it in, or even whether to disband it or not? What were some of the decisions you had to make about the company?
There was much that was difficult, but it was not difficult to decide to carry on the work because that's what he inspired us to do. He inspired us all to create a theater which would work toward a goal which is far from realized. And as long as there's going to be hunger and as long as there's going to be violence, I think we have some work to do and some work that he left unfinished, and I don't think any of us ever questioned that we should go on with it.
Is the Living Theater taking on any new directions now?
Yes, in a certain sense, one likes to say that the new direction is always deepening. But we're doing a play now. We're doing a play called Us by Karen Malpede at the Theater for the New City. And the play is a play about sex, about sexuality, about the trap that Freud described when he said that whenever two people make love, there are always six people in bed. That is, the parents of the woman and the parents of the man, or the parents of the two people, whether they be men or women, and that these six people are really present all the time. And this play is about getting those other four people out of that scene and leaving the lovers alone.
You're looking for a new home for the Living Theater now.
We are indeed. We have a wonderful company here. We have a company of 15 people in New York, 15 people in Europe. We got together and did one play, the Retrospectacle, for one night at the Cooper Union, and we won an Obie for it. And this wonderful company needs a home, and there's a marvelous little synagogue that's long abandoned and fallen into decay on 7th Street between Avenue B and Avenue C, down here where the very poor live and where the artists live. And we're making a big campaign now to find the funding and to find the support to set up the Living Theater in that space.
Have you gone to see much theater in the years that you've returned to the United States? I'm thinking when the Living Theater first started, there really wasn't an off-Broadway, so to speak. And now there's a really thriving theater scene that's pretty outside of the mainstream. There's a lot of experimental theater that's been inspired from the theater that you've created in your company. Do you go to check that out?
I see as much as I can, but like all theater people, when you work, you can't go to see theater. But I see a lot of energetic things. I see a lot of wonderful, wonderful artists. And I see a theater that, while it's extremely daring, seems to have very little impact. That is, we can do wonderful things, and it doesn't matter, because we haven't been able to budge the culture. And until we find out what'll really budge the culture, what'll really make people move, not only what'll enthuse them to say, this is a very good play, this is very interesting, or I didn't like that, or I did like that, but to really have a theater that can create some impetus for action, that we seem not to have. And I think it frustrates all the artists that are working in the theater today.
You know, I've recently been reading your diaries, which were published. The diaries, I think, is from 47 to 57. And you wrote in them that when you were young, your mother used to sometimes perform dramatic readings of poetry, and that you'd sometimes find it very upsetting to see her taken over by this emotion, and you wanted your nice, calm mother back. And I was wondering, I know you have two children, if you think that they ever went through that, knowing what you were doing on stage. Now, I don't know if they came to your performances a lot, but certainly certainly the kinds of things that you were doing on stage were much more emotionally dramatic than your mother reading a poem. Were they shocked by things that they saw you doing?
I think they entered into the theater life very early and knew what it was really from the first in a way that I really didn't understand. They were living not only with theatrical parents, they were living within a theatrical company. And everybody they knew acted. And they acted very young. And they came into it very young. And I think adapted to it very young. Yet I think there is for every theater child a certain moment of shock in seeing. For instance, it's very hard to explain to the young children in the company. One time we were traveling with nine young children, to explain to them why they shouldn't play with guns, but we used guns on the stage. That's a very difficult moral difficulty for the child. If we're playing with guns and they understand it's not real guns, why they can't play with guns, or why they shouldn't play with guns, or what's the matter with playing with guns since we, in enacting scenes, use them. This is an interesting kind of more moral question. It's a little more sophisticated than just being afraid of your good mother suddenly turning into that is, my daughter Isha, I was pregnant with Isha when I was playing Antigone, and then when she was 7 weeks after she was born, she sat in a basket at the side of the stage or backstage during the performances when she was just really a tiny infant. And I don't think that... And later she played in Antigone and became one of the actors in that play. So that there was never a time when she didn't know, when there wasn't an Antigone. That play, she was born into it, and she played it later, and it's always been part of her life. Even though it has some horrendous scenes, those are scenes that she knows from earliest childhood, and that are part of her vision of the world, that people do this, and that it isn't in fact hurtful, and that it is, in fact, creates a lot of good energy and enthusiasm.
You came out of a home that was pretty religious. Your father was a rabbi. Did your parents have any objections to you not only going into theater, but also living a very radical, very bohemian life?
I think maybe the radical bohemian part troubled my mother later. But I was intended to become an actress. My mother was an actress. And my mother met a young rabbi who was still a rabbinical student at the time and had to give up the theater. Though she had, she was already an admirer of the young director, Erwin Piscator. But she gave it up, and she gave it up with the agreement that they too would have a child, a daughter, who would become the actress instead of my mother. That is, I'm a surrogate for my mother, so that I was trained to be in the theater from the very beginning. I was meant to be in the theater, and I always considered it like part of my destiny. My father died when I was 13, so he didn't see me get very radical. Though I already had problems about hating Nazis, I already had pacifist problems with him about that. But later, surely, the bohemian way of life did trouble my mother.
Can I ask how you met Julian Beck?
How did I meet Julian Beck? I met Julian Beck because I was hanging out when I was 17 years old in front of an actors club called Genius Incorporated here on 46th Street. And I was waiting to have some interesting contact with real actors. And I didn't know many real actors. And I was very in awe of real actors. And I was eating chocolates in front of the in front of Genius Incorporated, the St. James Hotel. It's still standing there. The St. James Hotel is still standing there. And a young man came by and said, "I'm hungry. I haven't eaten for 2 days. Could you give me a piece of chocolate?" And I gave him all the chocolates in my pocket. And he was a very talkative young man, and I took him into the, and he told me how he was a young actor who hadn't made any progress, and he had nothing to eat. So I took him into the automat next door, and I bought him a sandwich, and he said, "I'm going to do you a favor because of what you have done for me. I'm going to call up a young man who is the most witty, the most brilliant, the most magnificent, the most poetic, the most fantastic person you've ever met." And he went and he called Julian Beck and said, "I have met a woman who is the most marvelous, the most witty, the richest." I was on home relief at the time. I was on welfare. "The richest, the most beautiful." I was far from that. "The most marvelous woman you ever met. You must come down here and meet her." And he brought me together with Julian Beck, and the moment we looked at each other, we knew that we had much work to do together and much life to live together.
It sounds like there was a certain amount of theater behind your meeting.
Yes, there seemed to be. My life has been, I've been blessed with a lot of theatrical events. This is good for writing a publishable diary.
You bet. Well, Judith Malina, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts with us. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
My guest has been Judith Malina. She and her late husband, Julian Beck, co-founded the Living Theater. It became one of the most revolutionary theater groups in the world. She's now directing Us at the Theater for the New City in Manhattan. It's a play by Karen Malpede. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with singer Regina Resnick. For years, she was a mezzo-soprano with the Metropolitan Opera. She retired from opera and is now performing in the revival of Cabaret on Broadway. I hope you can join us. This is music from The Connection. It features Freddie Redd and Jackie McLean performing. The Connection was produced by the Living Theater and directed by Judith Malina in 1959.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we learn about the roots of Ed Ward, the Fresh Air commentator who tells us about the roots of rock and roll. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Wingspan, the new album from Mulgrew Miller, a pianist influenced by McCoy Tyner. And television critic David Bianculli reviews EastEnders. It's the most popular primetime soap opera in Great Britain. Now it's coming to America on many public television stations. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. The dollar closed slightly higher on most foreign exchanges today after joint efforts by central banks to slow the currency's rapid decline. But NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports from London that government intervention may not be enough to keep the dollar from falling further.
After it looked as if the dollar would continue its downward plunge today in the Far East, various central banks, beginning with the Bank of Japan, stepped in to buy massive amounts of dollars to prop up the currency. The West Germans, the Swiss, and the U.S. Federal Reserve all intervened in foreign exchange markets today, buying perhaps $1 billion to $1.5 billion in a coordinated attempt to stem the dollar's decline. That intervention worked, and the value of the dollar rose against all major currencies in mostly quiet trading. A report in Paris said today's intervention was part of a secret agreement among the seven major industrial nations. Foreign exchange dealers are skeptical. They believe that over the long term, even massive intervention will be unable to reverse market sentiment against the dollar, that is, without clear support from the U.S. government in the form of higher interest rates. The Reagan administration wants to avoid higher interest rates so as to not tip the U.S. economy into a recession during an election year. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
Stock prices were sharply higher in the first trading day of the new year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 76 points to close at 2015.25. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, today, 50,000 people are expected to lose their water supplies. Emergency crews are racing to contain a 92-mile oil spill that's contaminated two of the city's three rivers. And it's threatening to shut off drinking water for as many as 750,000 suburban residents. By early this afternoon, no communities had lost their water supplies, but fire department spokesman Don Withers said the main tank is nearly empty.
We're just getting word today that the water in the Pittsburgh area is getting low, and several places in Pittsburgh are at this time out of water.
The Western Pennsylvania Water Company shut off two of its intake valves from the rivers to prevent water contamination. The spill began Saturday night when a fuel tank collapsed and sent about 1 million gallons of diesel fuel into the Monongahela River. A West German diplomat in Paris was shot and killed today. A leaflet found in his pocket claimed that a Kurdish nationalist group was responsible. But later, a statement issued in the Kurdish group's name denied responsibility. The diplomat was shot as he walked on a footbridge over the Seine. His attackers fled immediately after the assault. At the trial of 40 people suspected of involvement in the murder of Philippine opposition leader Benigno Aquino, the chief prosecutor has named the man he says might have carried out the murder. Humphrey Hawksley reports from Manila.
The announcement from the chief prosecutor, Mr. Raul Gonzalez, is a major breakthrough in the 4-year investigation to find the man who murdered Mr. Benigno Aquino. Mr. Gonzalez named Constable Rogelio Moreno of the Aviation Security Command, one of the defendants, as the man who was directly behind Mr. Aquino when he was about to step off an airliner after arriving in Manila from 3 years exile in the United States. Mr. Gonzalez said the constable could have been the assassin, and he identified him after a surprise witness came forward with a graphic account of the killing. The witness, an airport worker, said he was driving a towing tractor at the airport when he saw a soldier point a gun at the nape of Mr. Aquino's neck and shoot. That testimony could prove crucial to the outcome of the trial, which took another turn in the day's proceedings when Mr. Gonzalez interrupted the testimony to announce that he had received a death threat.
Humphrey Hawksley reporting for the BBC. A French journalist today was sentenced to 10 years in prison for spying in Afghanistan. The reporter was convicted by a special revolutionary court in Kabul. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from pianist Mulgrew Miller and his quintet. In the early 80s, Miller was a member of trumpeter Woody Shaw's quintet, and later he joined drummer Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. Miller is now 32, and Kevin says his new album shows that a great piano player is shaping up to be a great leader, too.
Mulgrew Miller is one of the hardest working musicians in jazz. He seems to turn up on a new album every month. He emerged a few years ago as the most interesting young player inspired by McCoy Tyner, who is the most influential jazz pianist since 1960. But lately, Miller has grown out from under his mentor's shadow. Where Tyner is splashy and expansive, Miller's sound on his new album Wingspan is more spare and compressed, harking back to Bud Powell's lean bop inventions. Here's Mulgrew Miller on his composition, The 11th Hour. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about Wingspan, Miller's third recording for the Landmark label, is not that he's revised his piano conception, but that he's assembled a group whose collective style is an extension of his own. Like his playing and his writing, his quintet declares a return to bop basics. Their approach is crisp and pointed. Kenny Garrett on alto and flute, Charnette Moffat on bass, and drummer Tony Redis play superior modern bop. But Steve Nelson's vibraphone sounds downright archaic. Nelson rejects Gary Burton's four-mallet chordal style. Instead, he echoes Lionel Hampton's hard-hitting two-mallet approach. Steve Nelson is featured on Miller's Soul Leo, a tune obviously indebted to Ramsey Lewis. Thank you.
Mulgrew Miller's compositions are the main reason the players sound so inspired. They recombine orthodox phrases in novel ways, so his bop sounds authentic and surprising at the same time. The two tunes he didn't write, Kenny Garrett Bossa Nova and the standard I Remember You, don't inspire the band quite as much. Bop long ago became jazz's status quo. Miller's quintet lets us hear it afresh and do it with uncommon good cheer. At a time when too many young boppers sound maudlin at best, these players sound like they're enjoying themselves. Miller's still fronting trios and clubs, but this quintet should be working on a regular basis. The band deserves a chance to grow.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed Mulgrew Miller's new album, Wingspan, on the Landmark label. Listening to Fresh Air. From time to time on Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with our regular contributors so we can find out more about the people who each week offer their views on music, film, and popular culture. Today we profile Ed Ward, our commentator on the history of rock and roll. Ed grew up in New York and has lived in San Francisco and Austin, his current home. Ed began writing about rock and roll in 1967 for Crawdaddy magazine and has since written about music for Rolling Stone, Cream, and the Austin American Statesman. He now writes for the Austin Chronicle. He also co-wrote the book Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, contributing the chapters covering the years up to 1960. I wondered how Ed first started listening to rock and roll.
I can blame this on a kid named Jeffrey Schlossberg, who I was going to school with in third grade, or maybe second. He came into school and said, you know, you better watch out, because my brother's turned into a rock. I'd never heard this term before. In fact, it's a fairly localized one, but essentially what had happened was his brother was in high school, and he had decided to become a hood, and he'd gotten himself a Harley Davidson and a leather jacket. And so I figured, well, you know, this was a guy whose right side I wanted to be on. So went over to Jeffrey's house after school, and we went into his sister's room, and he played a bunch of records that he said would help me understand what this whole phenomenon was about.
What did he play for you?
Well, he played a lot of Elvis Presley records, and to me he sounded like some sort of amphibian singing at the bottom of a well or something. I really didn't like him at all. And he played, I think there was some Buddy Holly in there, and the stuff I responded to best, I guess, back in those days, was what has come to be known as doo-wop, you know, black harmony singing. I think that was probably because I was in the church choir, and I really liked to sing, and you hear one of these records on the radio, and you could sing along with it. You could, like, find a part in there that you could sing and harmonize with it.
How did you find out about black music?
Well, it was on the radio. I mean, in those days, believe it or not, Top 40 radio was integrated, very much unlike what it is these days. If a record isn't made with a specific crossover intent these days, you generally won't hear it on Top 40. But in those days, rock and roll radio consisted of, there was even country music on rock and roll radio in those days, people like Don Gibson, and that stuff was very much what country people were listening to, and the black stuff, you know, like Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, or the Moonglows, or people like that, were very much what black people were listening to.
Did you go through periods of abandoning rock and roll for other music?
Oh yeah, during the early '60s, I got disgusted with rock and roll radio because there was less black music being played and more stupid music manufactured for teenagers kind of thing. The infamous Philadelphia sound of Fabian, Frankie Avalon, and all that garbage. And I remember one day I just got so mad, I twisted the dial as hard as I could, and the dial spun all the way down to the end, and I hit WQXR, which was the classical station in New York City, and began listening to classical music pretty much from that moment on. At about that same time, I befriended a pair of twins who were in my junior high school, and their parents had been heavy leftists, and the kids were really into folk music, and we used to go into New York City and see Pete Seeger, and I really got into the folk thing at that point. Pretty much stayed that way till I went to college in 1965.
And then what?
Well, then I came home for Christmas vacation, and my best friend's little brother started making fun of me for being a folky. And he said, well, you know, the Rolling Stones have recorded a protest song. I said, yeah, sure. You know, the Rolling Stones are just a bunch of commercial pop music mongers. But he put on Satisfaction. And I thought, well, gee, that's a pretty catchy record. So I started listening more to rock and roll at that point.
So the Rolling Stones drew you back into rock and roll?
Yeah. Yeah, the Rolling Stones. And shortly after that, I guess Rubber Soul came out. And I thought, well, this is sort of the Beatles doing folk music. It was a good time to get back into it. I guess by about 1966, I was really heavily back into it. And I still think of that as, along with 1957, one of the true golden years of rock and roll, because it was just before rock and roll lost its innocence, before the calculatedness came back into it and the sort of people all grasping to become huge stars. There was a lot of really great records that came out in 1966 that were real innocent because nobody really knew what was happening, but they were doing it anyway.
How did you start writing about rock music?
I'd been at school for about 3 weeks, and I was already bored. This was college. And I was a subscriber to a folk music magazine in New York, and I started sending them book and record reviews, and they printed them. I thought, well, gee, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer, which is, you know, still the case. And here I am, being a writer. So at one point, I was living in New York City, and I read a piece in the Village Voice about Crawdaddy magazine, which had just moved to town from Boston. That was January 1967. So what happened was I wound up moving into the Crawdaddy offices and writing for them. And in about, late 1969, I got a copy of Rolling Stone magazine, and there was a call for writers there. And so I submitted some stuff and started publishing and haven't really stopped since.
When you say you moved into the Crawdaddy offices, I have a feeling you mean literally that you
there. Yeah, we had this great loft at on 6th Avenue, great big old floor, and we just scavenged a couple of mattresses, and that was, you know, we all lived and worked there.
On Fresh Air, you do pieces on the history of rock and roll, and you've also written about that for the Rolling Stone, History of Rock and Roll. How did you become interested in the history of the music? How did you first start researching it?
Well, I always, see, the thing is that was part of believing that rock and roll doesn't exist in a vacuum, that there were all of these different streams that eventually fed into what's happening now and that are still feeding in. It's just, you know, it seems to me that looking at the big picture is the only way to really understand the little picture that's in front of us day by day.
Now, in Philadelphia, where I live, there's a new proliferation of oldie stations, of stations that only play music from the 60s, basically, early through late 60s. And I wonder if you think that this is a good trend or a bad trend. I know that it's happening to some degree around the country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the largest growing radio format that exists at this point. And that I find that to be really chilling because their view of rock and roll history is an ugly one. I mean, you're not going to hear the Moonglows. You're not going to hear the Five Royales. You're not going to hear anything obscure or anything that's like too ethnic. It's a very carefully managed, very carefully selected view of the past on those stations, and I really don't like that.
On Fresh Air, we think of you as a historian of rock and roll, but I bet you listen to a lot of contemporary rock music.
Oh, I listen mostly to contemporary rock music. It's only when I have to do these shows that I pull out I pull
we
out the old
records
and go, geez. No, I mean, one of the great things about right now is that a lot of the great records of the past are being remastered and reissued. And to that extent, I'm not a record collector nerd, you know. If somebody finds one of my favorite records and remasters it and puts it out on a clean pressing, hey, I'd rather have that than the original.
In Austin, you're still writing about rock music, you're writing about books, and you're also writing about food. You also teach cooking courses, and you teach courses in Cajun cooking. Since you're a native New Yorker, I find it almost ironic that you're teaching courses in Cajun cooking.
Well, actually, the key element here is the fact that I lived in San Francisco. Uh-huh. During the Second World War, a bunch of people from Louisiana moved to California to get into the shipbuilding industry. And those Louisiana people stayed on. And early in my stay in San Francisco, I began to go to black Catholic churches where Zydeco music was played, and there would be gumbo for sale there. And since I've always liked to cook, I just started making Louisiana food and started researching it. And years before I'd ever been to Louisiana, actually. And the weird thing was I had friends who were from Louisiana, and they used to come over for dinner and say, man, you know how to do this, don't you? And I didn't really back then, but I'm getting closer.
Okay. Ed, it was really nice to talk with you.
Oh, it's great talking with you.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's regular contributor on the history of rock and roll. He spoke to us from NPR station KUT in Austin. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, tonight we take a look at the background of deportations in the West Bank. The first deportations took place within months of Israel occupying the West Bank in 1967. And since then, Israel has used deportations to essentially get rid of Palestinians there who are troublesome to Israel. Also, we go to Paris tonight to take a look at the second national dance contest, especially designed for people over 50. There's waltzing, tangos, and all kinds of ballroom dancing. Also in Japan, sex and violence in the comics.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our television critic David Bianculli has a review of EastEnders. It's a BBC soap opera that's crossing the ocean this weekend. After its first episode, it will be seen five nights a week. The premiere is hosted by a popular British personality, and it's not Alistair Cook.
British comedian Tracy Ullman will be popping up on a lot of public TV stations this weekend. She'll be trying to sell Americans on the virtues and appeal of EastEnders, a British soap opera that's starting a minimum one-year run on American public TV. EastEnders is about the residents of London's working-class East End, and it's England's most popular program, getting more viewers than Dallas and Dynasty combined. And at the outset of the movie-length premiere episode, Ullman is quick to point out why.
Gone are the corporate giants, shyster lawyers, and malevolent moguls. Instead, EastEnders focuses on everyday people and gritty issues like unemployment, teenage pregnancy, rape, and suicide.
But let's not kid ourselves here. EastEnders isn't too far away from Dallas, except in terms of geography. The central couple, who operate the local pub, are a working-class version of J.R. and Sue Ellen Ewing. He schemes at business and cheats on his wife, and she drinks a lot and has affairs of her own. They even have a young daughter who's like a Cockney version of Lucy Ewing. She dresses in micro-mini skirts and has eyes for every guy at her parents' bar, even the young stock boys.
Give us a drink.
Mm-mm. You're too young. Besides, I'd have your old man down on me.
I hate this sort of party. Well, it's all old people, isn't it? Would you like my new outfit?
Yeah, it's terrific.
Dad reckons the top's too low cut. You know what parents are like. He still thinks I'm a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I asked him to put some decent music on.
Yeah, it might brighten things up a bit.
They'll probably dig out the old carpenter records.
There are more than 20 regular characters running through EastEnders, and I do mean running. The pace of EastEnders, compared to American soaps, is like the difference between regular tape speed and fast-forward. In the first half hour, there's a murder, an affair, an unexpected pregnancy, and a fistfight. And, of course, lots of verbal arguments. Like this one, where a woman who lives in her mother's home tells her that she and her unemployed husband are bringing home a surprise.
Yes, Mum, we're having a baby, and we're glad. And if you can't be glad for us, well, it's too bad. Because we're having a baby because we want it. We are having the baby. We, not you.
Yeah. Who do you think you're shouting at then?
You!
Well, just you remember, all of you, this is my house.
So?
So, because of all this ruction, I've missed me bingo. Now, get out me way.
That last line, by the way, had something to do with rapture and bingo. The Cockney accents are pretty rough at times, but it's a little like Shakespeare. Even when you don't understand the word, the inflection helps a lot. And so, in the initial episode, does Tracy Ullman.
Later, we're going to hear Ethel ask if everyone is having a lie-in. She means sleeping in late. Allie likes to chuck arrows, throw darts. Someone's dole is their welfare check. Fags are cigarettes.
The last time I can remember a TV show that sent out a glossary with its promo material was Shogun, which soon had viewers across America repeating simple Japanese phrases like domo arigato. If EastEnders catches on here, it could do the same thing for Cockney, because the slang is quite colorful. Sometimes it's even poetic. My favorite phrase is, a cup of cold sick, the most polite term I've ever heard for the word vomit. Having seen only 1 week's worth of EastEnders, I can't judge how good it is. In Cockney terms, I can't say it's brill, but it doesn't look like a bent set of tools either.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with pianist Rand Blake. He heads the third stream department at the New England Conservatory of Music. Blake has broadened the definition of third stream to include compositions influenced not only by jazz and classical musics, but by musics from around the world. His first recording session has just been reissued, and he also has two new albums. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators, a 60s group that put Texas on a psychedelic par with California. And humorist Alice Kahn will reflect on the bittersweet process of moving. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.